Welcome back to the Stanford Healthcare AI podcast. And so thrilled to be joined by Dr. Jessica Mega, who also is on faculty at Stanford, practicing cardiologist, was chief medical officer at Google, then co-founder, chief medical officer at Verily. And most of you have already probably seen her profile before. We're just so thrilled to have her here today.
Thanks. It's amazing to be here, and the work you're doing is really helpful for the community.
So maybe just to kick things off, and we were already starting to chat about this as we were getting on, but adoption continues to rise, and we continue to see more, it feels like every month on these topics where models are going. And so, Matt, help ground us here to a few of these data points that we're looking at here around adoption, downloads, usage, and just help ground us.
Yeah, I mean, I know we kind of have this thread going as part of like a longer conversation between the different episodes, but I guess I'm continually amazed. I think those of us who spend a lot of time thinking about this maybe sometimes assume that, okay, everyone is aware and everyone's already been using the models and has a formed an opinion. And when you see these continued spikes and the usage keeps going up, the number of downloads it seems to be sustained at least for the last month at 1 million a day, and then you're kind of seeing this asymptotically increasing, spike in users. It just, I guess, it reminds me that hey, maybe we are pretty early. And I do feel like once in a while I'll bump into somebody who is just kind of really digging in, as opposed to just like the casual, hey, my kid used it for homework one day, or I tried to write an email with it one time. Now it's like it's actually a part of my daily routine for a lot of different tasks. I don't know what you all think. I mean, I don't know if I'd call myself a power user per se, but I would say that I spend a lot of time trying out the models in different ways, and in particularly testing them in various healthcare scenarios. But I guess I sometimes make the maybe it's the wrong assumption that everyone is already doing this. And I guess this kind of data shows me that, the classics, we're early still. It feels like we're still early. I don't know. What do you guys think?
What I find interesting that you brought up is there's a range of use cases and there are a range of groups who are using it. And what I've found is when people start to use these tools and it provides value, it's like this amazing flywheel, right? And it's one of those things where I know personally I started around what I would call more traditional use cases, let's say helping with a letter or an email. And then you said, okay, can you translate that? Okay, that gets you hooked on to another type of aspect. And then I've gone from what I would call more standard tasks to much more creative tools. And that's, I think, where the hook is. And one of the observations I've personally made is I think sometimes we're not always thinking about getting the right tool for the right fit. So if if you want to add two numbers, then a calculator is really good. Like grab that calculator and stick with it. When you want more creative ideation, you want to brainstorm around a concept, I started to work with some of the models around a talk that I was going to give. And it was one of the best brainstorming tools that was out there. And so I think we're going to get better and better for the right tool at the right time. And this is both in the world broadly and particularly in medicine. So that's what I'm seeing as these tools are being delivered.
Well, we'll talk more about the medicine aspect. I mean, we could talk about the consumer uses of AI. I'm using translation now, speaking to my mother-in-law in Vietnamese back and forth. But let's ground it in medicine. And where are you? Because you're still practicing, as we were just talking about before. Are you starting to use any tools like this in your practice? Actually, Stanford just launched their own, chat with their EMR. There's a few other companies and places where that's starting to go. Have any of these made it into your practice yet? Have you started to see any of these tools, or in your mind, are they still a little bit too early?
Yeah, so what I'll do is I'll give three examples, sort of sticking with the line of thought of right tool for the right moment. So when we are doing things where it's more rules-based, so something like drug-drug interactions that we all know that are out there, we do a pretty good job of trying to remember our pharmacology, but those are very basic rule-based algorithms that are out there. Or for example, risk scoring when we're trying to decide whether someone needs to have other testing before surgery. We don't want anything that deviates from the rules that we know. So that's something I think we all hold hands and say, this is tools that we've agreed on, and we don't really need to iterate on those. And then we have this second bucket, and this is where you're seeing most of the tools that are being approved by the FDA. There were about 220 approved AI tools in predominantly cardiology and radiology, where, and I'll just give you an example, something that I was able to work on, where we're looking at fundus images to help patients with diabetes get triaged for care. And as it turns out, these models are really actually better than an individual reader. And that shouldn't surprise us, right? We're using deep learning, we're doing multiple training sets for a very discrete task. And I think that there is pretty universal acceptance when we feel like we understand if something's safe, effective, and valuable, we'll take it. The places where you're starting to see the most acceleration with more of the generative tools are actually on two very different ends of the spectrum. And this gets back to my concept around creativity, this idea of looking at patterns and trying to predict new patterns. And we may get into more detail around this, but one is really thinking about biology broadly and understanding, for example, how proteins work in the world, thinking about new drug development, and then also working with patients, thinking about how do we deliver information at the right time in the most interesting way. So it's this spectrum between rules-based to the most creative based mechanisms that we need. And so those are three different places which today these tools are being deployed.
Well, and I'll push back a little bit on that because I totally agree with you on each of those categories. But what I'm starting to see is like as a user of all those tools, like do you have to have five different UIs? Do you have to have a bunch of tools on your desktop? Or are we now, again, to catch another buzzword of the agent space, would I have a model that understands my intent well enough that I can just talk to one model? And then each of those applications that you reference are now tools for the model to then bring the relevant information from those narrow models back to me, and I can still have that. I think this is the tension I'm starting to feel now, where again, this accelerated pace, the general interest in sort of, hey, I've really used this conversational, easy UI approach, and I've gotten a lot of value out of it, as you've said in your personal life. Now you're thinking about, well, maybe I don't want to open up the calculator app, or I don't want to open up a risk scoring app. Just go find that for me and get and do you feel like that is a logical kind of progression to this? Because those 220 now probably gonna continue to expand FDA cleared deep learning solutions, like. Do I have to find a way to cobble them all together to get the benefit of each of those innovations, or can I just abstract that away and continue to have a quote unquote, co-pilot or companion of some kind that's able to? And then there's a lot of downstream challenges with that. Is that really part of the way that they were intended to be used or built, and et cetera, et cetera? But just in a general way, maybe I'm lazy. I just want to work with one thing, and I just want to have it do those other things for me so I don't have to like use my limited brain power.
Well, okay, so no one's going to call you lazy today. But what I can say is the places where you're seeing the most traction are places where these tools are embedded into the workflow, right? So we talk about scribe technology a lot, and it's really for people who have used it and have had positive experiences. The acceptance and adoption is going up, right? And the reason why is it's built into your day-to-day workflow. The same thing is true for the number of approved tools that I talked about. The ones that are getting traction are built into the workflow of a given cardiologist, radiologist, and soon many other fields, right? And so right now we have to think about how do we make it simple for not just you, Matt, but for everyone. Going forward, I think you're right. There are going to be platforms. It's going to be more of the platform technologies that allow this to be much more seamless. No one's going to log into 100 different portals. It's unrealistic. So I think we look to see where the adoption is and how do we make interoperability more of a reality so that we can actually take good care of our patients. I would actually take it one step further and say that if we're really ambitious and we start to think about who we're actually caring for, we're caring for real people. We're caring for patients. And as much as I may have a relationship with someone, they may ultimately go to a number of different hospitals. And they may not only may, but what happens in the four walls of the hospital is a very limited moment in time for that individual, right? We have this idea that someone's healthy until they're sick, but that's just not the way the world works. So if you really wanted to plant a true North Star, it's thinking about that individual and how do we create tools that follow them throughout their longitudinal life, right? So again, we know where we are now. We know where we need to be, but I just continue as we all go through this journey, think about the people we're serving and how we bring down the fragmentation in healthcare.
So there are like four different things you said that I just love. One, totally agree on the platform nature of what's coming. There's no way we get to the health system of tomorrow with 40 different widgets or avenues to do that. But I would also agree we're nowhere near that yet, right? Even, the most advanced, ChatGPT, the most adopted thing, you still have to pick which of like the 10 different models do I actually want to talk to. It's a terrible user experience, but everyone else has just copied it because that's the best we've come up with so far. So someday we'll get there on that. But the consumer aspect, Jessica, that you talk about, we're seeing echoes of this actually on the policy side as well. We're seeing the wearables push from RFK. We're seeing interoperability and CLEAR around data. And I'm curious, as you think about this consumer push, especially from your lens at Verily, like you were pushing wearables, other technology, had the resources to think very beyond traditional healthcare. So I guess maybe what you can share, take us through like what's your vision of kind of that consumerization of what might be possible with AI in this? What did you get to work on before? What did you feel like you had success in? What was hard? And like how does that relate now with the current set of AI tools?
Yeah. So I'll walk through an example that I think is illustrative of where we could go as a system. And it goes back to putting that person in the center of their healthcare. So one area that we were able to focus on and there continues to be work on is with cardiometabolic disease. And we know that the number of people with diabetes, if you look not only in the United States, but you look internationally, has really been on the rise. And so the question is, how do you get the right care to patients? Because we certainly don't have the number of endocrinologists that we might need to support people, not only with diabetes, but even pre-diabetes. And so it started off with thinking about certain tools that people might need. And one of those tools could be a continuous glucose monitor. Not that everyone has to wear it all the time, but the insights around your own biology, the fact that we call type 2 diabetes one thing is when you look at the data, some people are having huge excursions, right? They have hypoglycemic and they're hypoglycemic, they're up and down, and some people ride. There's clearly heterogeneity. And so we were able to work in partnership with Dexcom to create new continuous glucose monitors that had a different form factor, were easier to use, factory calibrated. You then pull that information in and you show it. So let's say the three of us go out to dinner and we're playing afterwards, we play cards and we all have a cookie. As it turns out, we respond very differently to that food. And so that information is surfaced, yes, to a clinical support system, but it's surfaced to an individual who's then empowered to help through generative AI think about what are some choices that people can use. And then behind that, there's a clinical care team. So this continuous understanding of information coming in and action coming out is really a fundamental principle. And I think about if you want to be really simple with a lot of the work that we're doing with AI and beyond, what information do we have and how can we make a difference and make an action? And so we were able to run clinical trials that showed these tools actually reduced hemoglobin A1C, right? And that's the metric. We measure medicines based on that metric. So that just gives you an illustration of what I think is possible more broadly across many different conditions. Again, it's the human machine interface, I think, what made it particularly useful.
Yeah, and I mean that kind of ties back to what you were saying before too, which is that we see our patients in these episodic care instances, right? And we don't have that visibility in a lot of cases, even if they are being monitored, of what's going on in the meantime, right, between the visits. And further, they're going beyond glucose, which I think is obviously an area where there's a ton of opportunity. But outside of that, there's things like sleep, and we know there's behavioral and social issues, all these other things that we know impact outcomes and the effectiveness of the things that we do for our patients. It does make you wonder, like, is there a way to start to capture some of that longitudinal, all those other, what you would kind of call data exhaust, I think a lot of people call it, but the things that happen in between. Did you find that that kind of regular interaction, maybe as part of a clinical trial, so it's somewhat artificial in the sense that maybe that's not the routine, but nonetheless, that must have also helped. And then taking that a step further, Justin, you have some graphics on this, but we're seeing patients already kind of putting their medical data into the models, that the consumer-facing models, having these longer conversations about their healthcare and some of the decisions they're making. Is there a place where these start to blend together? I mean, we've learned from the data, like the work that you've done, that having that other information, that more granular, we can take better care of our patients. How do we bring these together? And here's an example. This is from a Reddit thread, so take it for what you will. But it's someone, and you see many, many, many versions of this story. I went to the hospital. I felt a little weird about the diagnosis that they made. I took my data. I had a long 2-hour long chat with the model, and it came up with a completely different answer. And I went back, and then they confirmed it. There's so many versions of these stories now. Obviously, there's sampling bias, and there's all kinds of challenges with taking a lot of this and making big decisions about it. But I do feel like it's a trend. And if I'm being perfectly honest with you all, I do have conversations with the model about my own health, decisions and data. And honestly, I do, just partially to push it, and partially because I'm not an expert in a lot of aspects of medicine for sure. And so is it helping me? I think it is. But then how do I translate that to my actual care team? What's that future going to have to look like in order to get the benefits of both?
Well, I can jump in with a few more data points, and then Jessica, you're up with the answer for what the future looks like in the care team and everything that happens. But the 800 million active users from ChatGPT, from different discussions, 5 to 10% of those queries are health related. That's a wild, wild number. And I know we had Google searches before where people were bringing in information, but I think to all of us, it feels different. I do it too all the time, to kind of understand more about a condition or a symptom or something that comes in. And it's way better. And for all the studies we've looked at, and we won't show you more charts today of performance outperforming doctors or outperforming doctors with AI, but what does that care team look like? So the easy questions for you, Jessica, like
Yeah,
what does
sure.
that look like?
Yeah, sure. Softball. So I have two thoughts here. One is, how do we handle this information? Back to the information action, and then we'll get to Matt's other question, which is, what does it mean to have multidimensional data in the real world that goes beyond maybe what we just think about as the health layer? Okay, so going back to the first one around information, you used the percent that it's about 10% of people are using certain whether it's ChatGPT or otherwise, they're using these tools for health information. And the reality is that's going to go up. And we saw the same thing with search and other things. So the piece where I'll give you the optimistic view and then a few wrinkles. So the optimistic view is, so if the three of us were sitting around in the 1600s and we had a patient and we were worried that they might be anemic, we might take maybe some of their blood and we'd put in a tube and we would shake it and we'd look to see, try to estimate a hematocrit. And nowadays, I think it's great that we have cell counters and we don't question them at all. And we're not sitting around trying to estimate the hematocrit and we're not, debating about the width of the cells. We're not looking to see if the MCVs are different. And so we trust these tools because it goes back to them being safe, effective, and valuable. And as long as the information that we glean using different generative AI tools is of that caliber, we should lean into that because you know what that does? That makes us action agents. So we're like, the healthcare system it turns into like superheroes, right? So we don't have to own all the information, but we figure out what do we do with that information. Who, for example, we trust troponins. People come in with a heart attack. And their troponin is elevated, and I know they're going to benefit from a cardiac catheterization. We use that information, again, whether it's a hematocrit, a troponin, something that comes from an image, because we know it's actionable. And so, as long as the information we're getting from generative AI provides that level of information, I think we should embrace it. The wrinkle that I talked about, and I was just doing an assessment for myself, looking at cardiac biomarkers to see how accurate is the information. It varies, right? It varies. And so we need to just get to a point where we feel comfortable with that information. But I have no concern in the same way, the stethoscope was a big deal several hundred years ago, right? People thought it would take people away from the patient. But we work with MRI scanners. Those are pretty, talk about technology, right? I mean, that's a big piece of technology. So the fear shouldn't be in the technology. It's really the what we're doing with it, and can we rely on it? So that's kind of how I see the human machine interface, and where I see action being so important. Okay, on the second one, I think we do underestimate what health information really means for a given individual. And sure, I started a lot of my career in clinical trials and working with genetics and pharmacogenomics in this world of precision medicine. So, right, so what biological features impact your health? And we can talk more about that if that's of interest. But over time, the aperture opened and I started to really think about precision health and what really is important in someone's health journey. And in some ways, whether someone has diabetes or they have a cancer diagnosis, there's a longitudinal journey that they are on. And that's where, Matt, to your question, when you think about that health data, that's where people estimate a 1500-fold increase in health information that can be very actionable on top of the diagnostics and the therapeutics. So, again, those would be roadmaps for both of these tools. Get information that we believe we can lean on in the way that we lean on all of the assays that we do today, and contextualize health not in a silo, but in the world that a given person is living in. So that's what I see as the true north.
I think that's a tremendous vision. I think it does tie together the learnings that we've had over the right. We've been chasing precision medicine for so long, and we know it's like there's a lot of pieces on the board, a lot of learnings. Tying this together, maybe this is a way to do that, and maybe the technology, maybe is part of the information asymmetry problem that we faced in the history of medicine. Right, like we had to spend, 10,000 plus hours to learn, and then we had to figure out how to translate that back into a relationship with our patients to go on that care journey to get to the diagnosis or to the treatment. And I feel like the information asymmetry may start to be leveling off with the availability of these tools to have a longer conversation. I have a 15-minute slot. I'm not going to be able to really get to the end of every one of the questions or the concerns that patients may have. I may not be able to even surface them in that time, but is this a kind of a companion technology that can kind of flatten that difference where we're on the journey together, and frankly, some of the things that we know and we want to do together are clear in both the patient and the physician's mind. That's the ultimate state, right? Is getting to the place where you are literally side by side with your patient going through the care process, right? And there's always that feeling today, at least in my experience, where I'm not 100% sure we're both on the same page at all times, right?
Well, it's so interesting, right? If you think about even medical training, we end up specializing because the only way we can really wrap our head around the information is, in many ways, knowing more and more about less and less, right? Really being the world's expert in a given area. And some of these tools may liberate us in that regard and even get us to start thinking across different disciplines, right? It's interesting if you look at the field of inflammation. Inflammation touches work that rheumatologists do, right? So, whether someone's seeing someone with lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, it affects oncology, it affects cardiology. But I think there's actually a moment for a much more expansive view of biology as we maybe take off some of the constraints that we needed before to really specialize. And there's a book called Range by David Epstein, and he talks about how potentially really knowing an area, but having a generalist mindset can in some ways create the most creative solutions. So we'll see where that piece leads us, but we have to keep an open mind about this idea of let's continue to move health forward. Because I think every person, probably all three of us on the call today, every person listening to this knows someone who has a health condition where we don't have a solution for it right now. So there's a lot of work for us to do. I have no fear about being replaced or not having enough work to do, but I want to make sure we're focused on the best and highest problems.
Agreed on that. And speaking of understanding the best and highest problems, places where we don't have treatments, this is neither Matt nor I's background, spending a ton of time on drug development, new areas, but this is something on across genomics and personalized medicine that you've lived for years. So I guess tell us what excites you. What parallels do you see with, the current revolution, if you want to call it, and kind of these tools to before with genomics? What excites you about how we can now apply these tools for, new treatments?
Yeah, so in my own personal journey in life has always been about how do you get new technologies to the hands of patients and clinicians. And that started off first, obviously, as a clinician, but doing clinical trials to understand how we get new medicines into the hands of those people I talked about and studied a number of antiplatelets and anticoagulants, which at the time, some now when I round with residents and fellows, some of these things seem like no-brainers, but we really were thinking about, do people need dual antiplatelet therapy, or how do we treat someone after a stent? And we didn't even really think that lipid lowering was going to be as effective as it is. But over time, learning about clinical trials and then realizing if all three of us were in a clinical trial, we probably don't respond to these medicines in the same way. So built out capabilities with the TIMI study group around studying genetics and genomics. And I actually see a lot of parallels between that early work and what I'm seeing with the deployment of AI and other decision support tools. And so the lessons that we learned in the early days of genomics, and you probably recall this, there was a lot of association studies. So people were associating this particular SNP with this finding, and everyone was really excited. And as it turns out, only about 25% of those studies could be replicated upfront. So it almost reminds me a little bit of what we're talking about with hallucinations. It was different because it was a statistical problem. It was essentially this multiple hypothesis issue. But we had to wrangle with what does replication look like? What does validation look like? What do we trust? How do we run a really good genome-wide association study? And then we also had compute go up, right? I remember the days we had this external hard drive, and I'd bring it over to my colleague, and then he'd work on it overnight. And then he'd bring it was this red, I remember it was kind of like this red maroon drive. And then I just kept thinking, gosh, what if we lose this? There's biological insights on this drive. Sorry, like double wrap it. Anyway, but so there was this combination of understanding statistically how to evaluate the genetics and then understanding and benefiting from compute, because we went from where we compute, right, on-prem, to how we compute in the cloud. And over time, we now are starting to see, particularly in the world of oncology, genetic-based therapies, and we're really getting a much better sense of targeting the right patient with the right therapy. And so you might ask, well, okay, what does that have to do with where we are today with AI? Well, it's a very similar thing of what can we replicate? What really stands the test of time? How do we use compute to its best and highest value, right? So nowadays, things are becoming really fast. And so how do we make decisions that used to take a lot of time, make them more real time? And then genomics is a static data. How do we integrate real time information? I gave the example of glucose, but that could be said for gait if someone has Parkinson's. There's so many examples. And so I think many of the parallels we learned years ago, we can apply here. And it's just an area of great interest to me. And then you ask, so what's most exciting? Well, the thing that's most exciting to me is much in the way we use genomics to continue to explore biology and get the best care for patients. I think AI is going to, as I already mentioned before, give us just a better understanding beyond a given discipline. Biology is very experimental right now. And if you talk to people who are in physics and other disciplines, they have laws, right? They have Newton's law and thermodynamics. And biologists are really, we're hoping we can get to that same place using a lot of these tools. And then on the personal end, getting the right information to individuals. So it's really, in some ways, technology meets humanity on steroids. So it's a daunting time, but I almost want us to hold hands and say, we have encountered things like this, and let's learn from those experiences.
I love this vision. I'm curious on as part of that, like as if all of the experience that you've had, again, I totally resonate, by the way, with the days of the hard drives and trying to run to the lab and like, wait, is this the I'm gonna lose this data. This is my whole career right here. But do you what I feel like I'm seeing, and again, this is both Justin and I believe are admittedly not as deep in the space, but if we agree that there's opportunities for new drug targeting, new drug discovery, small molecule development at scale, that can be at least more intelligently driven to have a higher likelihood of success in the next phases. What I wonder is, like, does that mean we have to change how we derive the quote unquote evidence in the sort of the phase two space? Because what I assume is going to happen, or it may already be happening, is that there's a ton of now candidates that are super promising, but they still have to go through the same like conveyor belt process for phase two that have all those same problems that we've always had: finding the right patients, filling the trials appropriately, dealing with all the paperwork and the regulatory aspect. Those feel like kind of ossified, challenging but necessary processes. Like, do you feel like we're going to have to think about how we do clinical trials in order to see the benefits of all the discovery happening today?
Yeah, so as you said, to boil it down, right, there's the target, there's the drug, and then there's the trial. And so there are going to be examples that people turn to are looking at certain diseases where we thought there was going to be resistance or antibiotic resistance. And now people are actually finding particular compounds that may be effective, that ones that what people said, oh, these certain areas are undruggable. You can see that also in oncology. And now people are coming up with new solutions. So your very prescient question is, okay, so potentially we find new targets. Ideally, we find better targets. So we know that there's about a 10% success rate as you go through that pipeline, right? So even going from 10 to 20%, let's keep it, let's say clinical trials stay at ossified, which they won't, and I'll get back to that. Even doubling the success rate by understanding the biology, both the toxicity as well as the efficacy up front is going to be helpful. But then we want to marry that with a more effective clinical trial system. And I believe you're talking to someone who trained as a clinical trialist. So clinical trials and randomization really is important. We have been burned by medicines that we just knew, we thought biologically they were going to work out. And I can give many examples of those. But we can do things more efficiently. And I'll give you real-time examples. So the first thing is just patient recruitment, reaching out to patients, let people know that there are trials available. Once someone understands a trial, how do we, it's like a fabric, how do we connect them to the sites? Right now, it's a pretty rudimentary process. In fact, we usually think it's success if it's one patient per site per month. We are seeing examples where we're doing so much better. Again, it's just connectivity. Then, in terms of understanding the data as it's coming in, doing real-time data monitoring, looking for anomaly detection, that used to be a very manual process. So, we would do source document verification. So, the three of us would sit there and we would look at this data. Is it going over here? Now, you can start to look at the data coming in, pick up pockets of variance where you could go and drill down. And then finally, regulatory submissions. It's a really great use case where people are collating the information. Things that used to take months to even a year are now taking a much shorter period of time. It's a really nice use case of some of the generative AI tools. So I think there's going to be progress on all of those fronts, but I don't, in fact, I wouldn't advocate getting rid of clinical trials and real testing of biology. But man, are we getting smarter? And so that's the piece. Again, we have to decide if we're a half full or half empty, but I think when you approach a problem and you're able to see multiple pieces that will line up to lead to efficiencies, that's a good place. The other thing is we're seeing real progress in all these. It's not, gosh, wouldn't that be nice? I always look at how rapidly we're learning. And the same thing can be true of models as we're starting to look at AI models. How much are they getting better? Are they getting smarter? It's almost like surrogate markers or surrogate endpoints. So I can tell you in the space that we're talking about here, things are getting better.
And it's not just the biologists, even the FDA, starting to rethink its own process. They announced their own internal AI tool, a handful of weeks ago to start to take again processes that used to take months down to hours or days. And so I think there is hope to optimism for optimism here. And I agree with you. It is very easy to get burned by associations. And just the rigor of clinical trials, which hopefully doesn't go away. I know we're just about at time for what we have together here, but you just have such a unique perspective on kind of having seen these changes come across medicine and technology. So, like, what's your crystal ball? What does 3 to 5 years look like? And we'll just bracket it towards clinical medicine in the middle wrap.
Yeah. So what I would say, and again, I hearken back to some of the lessons we learned around the applications of biomarkers and genetics and genomics. As we get a better handle on where that information is most useful, information that is actionable, we're going to see the same thing going on as we think about AI and generative AI. And as I look to the future, we're going to have a better sense of what we talked about at the very beginning, the right tool for the right job. And you could imagine moving forward as we get better at the information, as we link that to the ambient scribes, are there clinical tasks that could be done in a way that is more streamlined, that gives us in the healthcare professions more time to think about the new treatments, spend time with our patients? Absolutely. But the call to action is in the reason why people take new medicines and the reason why people get percutaneous valves and the reason why people get genetic testing for triage of their chemotherapy is because we believe in that data. And so I think the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see a real acceleration. It reminds me again, you can turn to and say, oh, there's hallucinations here or there, but I think we're missing the bigger picture of where we're seeing the biggest benefits and some of what we talked about. And let's think about the tools where, much like we talked about the cell counter and the complete blood count, let's use the tools really well. And let's free ourselves up to better humanity and think about these broader issues. So that's kind of the big picture of what I see.
Well, I feel like this is exactly the North Star. We and this part of the reason we do this podcast too is I think we really want to try to keep this conversation going and encourage folks to lean in. There's never been a better time to and there's never been better access to some of the most powerful tools on the planet. Having an intuition of where they work, where they don't, is only going to benefit all of us on all sides of the table. And I am glad that you didn't use the 1600 analogy of how we used to check for diabetes. So I like the blood count.
We can do that. We can do that next time. But I think that point, you just got me super energized. The people who are closest to the problems should really feel empowered to figure out how to use these tools. And so it really is, it's a moment to say, hey, as you walk around, whether you're a researcher, a clinician, someone who is working in health tech, look around at the problems you're trying to solve, because that's where the real magic comes, right? So it's a moment.
Amazing. With that, Jessica, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks.